thank you so much for coming here early this morning. I suspect many of you were enjoying things till later in the evening, so really appreciate you getting up early and coming out to hear, particularly from Danny. And thank you, Danny, for being here. I've got a few questions, but then we will open it up to the floor, so there'll be an opportunity for you to ask any burning questions. But first of all, an easy question to start. Could you just tell us what you mean by peak inequality from the title of the book?
If you don't want to get the book, if you Google peak inequality in my name, you'll find the New Statesman article which summarises it in three pages, which is much easier. There are many ways of measuring inequality. The way in which I do it is in terms of people's income. We could, except we're mostly English and we never worked, get you to all order yourselves in this tent by your household income. The way you would do it, don't worry, I'm not going to do this, is you quietly talk to your neighbour, talk about your family, how much the people who are earning are getting, how much people on the pension are getting, how much people on benefits are getting, and then swap places so that the one who's getting less sits on that side. And then we do it again and again and again for about 10 minutes. And we'll have the best off 1% over here, and the worst off 1% over here, and half of you would probably have left. And many of you would possibly not quite hold the truth to your neighbours as you're going through. Way back in 1913, which was the last peak of inequality in Britain, the best off 1% of people by income, 1 in 100, were getting about a quarter of all the income in the country every year, leaving 75% for everybody else. That got progressively better. The kind of bad news is that for the first 20 years when inequality falls, people tend not to notice, and it's still pretty awful. The 1920s and the 30s weren't great, but they're actually a time of growing equality. The 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s, it was more obvious. We became the most equal we'd ever been round about 1976, ever. In the history of humanity on these islands, and one of the most equal places in the world. If you remember 1976, it was actually quite good, simple employment. People had holidays. Half of all children in Britain now no longer have a summer holiday. Then the inequality rose and rose and rose again. So that now, the best off 10th of people in the country, in households getting probably more than £60,000 or £65,000 a year before tax, the best off 10th take 40% of all income, leaving 60% for everybody else. The best off 1% take 15% of all income. I'm afraid it's just all about numbers. That's higher than anywhere else in Europe. The best off 1% here take twice as much as the best off 1% in Switzerland. And Switzerland has a banking sector like we do. The reason the book's called Peak Inequality is it's quite optimistic. A lot of measures in 2016, 17, 18 were suggesting that we could possibly be at the peak as we last were in 1913. Last week some really, really good news came out by the IK Centre, who produced a report on the top paid people in Britain every year, and particularly the CEOs of the FTSE 100, and the headline was 13% drop in the incomes of the highest paid people in the country. It's slightly clutching of straws, yeah, but inequalities always do eventually peak. They always do fall, whenever we've measured them in any country, and sadly they tend to rise again when people take their eye off the ball and don't realise what they've got and what they've achieved. When inequality is at a very high peak, you have some of the very worst destitution. So a century ago, it was soup kitchens. Soup kitchens were the sign of how bad things were. Charities would provide soup kitchens. We eradicated soup kitchens. We forget we actually did this. They were not needed anymore. And I'd love to see the sort of chart of when they went, but they were certainly almost all gone by the 1960s and 70s. As inequality rises again, you have a group of people at the bottom who are very large, quarter to a third of the population, who are living lives that are incredibly precarious, who cannot save £10 a week. This is one of the reasons why half of the children in Britain have no holiday at all. Whereas, when you're on holiday now, yeah, this counts as a holiday, it's going away for at least one night, not staying with relatives. Our best off figure of children have an average of 6 or 7 holidays a year. And that's a sort of sign of inequality. It affects everything from the kind of education we have, the kind of lives we live, and issues that go from people like me, who I don't have to think about money for food. It's not an issue whatsoever. For people who have to go and ask for somebody to give them a voucher so they can then go and get food. And it directly relates. If you look at countries in the world, the rich world, which are more equal, they don't have food banks. There is no need, because the bottom section of society is so much better off in sort of measures.
One of the things that really struck me when I was reading the book was this, the phrase you said, that as a country approaches peak inequality, we plunge new depths of indecency in our perceptions of and behaviour towards those who are weakest. I think that would certainly be the experience of our food bank managers and volunteers. I think often when they're speaking to people who find themselves having to come to a food bank, the stories they hear are of experiencing unkindness and having to run the gauntlet in order to get the support they need in order just to be able to afford food. What are some of the behaviours that you've identified or incentives in this period of peak inequality?
It's interesting. These are hard things to measure in behaviour and attitudes. But again, if we go back in time towards, to the last slide before the First World War, the kind of behaviours to become normal, the most common job for women was to be a servant, maid servant. That was seen as entirely normal. And if you were in the top of society, you had to have servants. It would be embarrassing not to do that. But at the last peak, the Titanic sank. And if you will remember about the Titanic sinking, the famous statistics are about how many people died who were in third class, how few people died who were in first class, how it was seen as perfectly normal that those who paid more for their ticket should be taken off first in the lifeboats. Those kinds of attitudes disappear as we become more equal. You begin to think of other people as more like you. And then when you become more unequal again, one of the only ways in which you can sustain growing inequality is there has to be a physical justification for it. And the justification which is given and which rises to the fore is that some people are feckless. Some people will not work unless they're forced to work. The phrase from well over 100 years ago is that hunger is more effective than the overseer's whip. And this was a phrase used for breaking strikes, and the first big strikes that occurred when the unions were first forming. That the way you get people, particularly doctors, back to work is you starve them to work. And that human beings come in different kinds, a large mass of rather unable people who have to be frightened to behave, and then those of us who are better in somehow who are destined for other things. And you see it nowadays. Talk about, what's it, slackers, I forget all the words that we use. George Orwell used to use them. Instead of strivers versus slackers, nasty words. The idea of the layabout, can't bother to get out of bed to work, all of these kind of things. Whereas we then have a cult at the top of society of the amazing, hard-working entrepreneur. Richard Branson was always sort of put forward, this man who was working 13, 16 hours a day except when he's on his island in the Caribbean. And that's the model we should all aspire to be. And this is a slightly ridiculous, you know, you cannot all own a train line. There aren't that many. But the idea was there were a few people who were special and they should be allowed to have more. And then there's something lacking about people at the bottom. And giving them enough money to live, either through incomes which are adequate, and our incomes used to be higher in relation to food than they are now, or benefits which are adequate, that just encourages them not to try harder. And that's the kind of country we have largely become at the moment. We vary a lot. This tends to be a hell of a lot kinder than the population on average. On average in Britain, if I talk about these things, it's tricky because the stories you get are, oh, I know so-and-so who just wants to take drugs and drink and so on. What we never say is how lazy people at the top are. You know, it's actually, yeah, it's not that hard to get into your chauffeur-driven car and be driven to the office, to go into your air-conditioned office and to be your PA depending on what you're doing that day, and to go and have your expensive lunch meeting and then go off to the golf course and so on. So it's that kind of thing. And it permeates society. So the university, I work in the University of Oxford. During the 80s and the 90s, there was more and more talk about looking out for the golden children, the special children, the ones we will try to identify, that we will take out, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, from the masses, and elevate up to be a future leader. That kind of talk goes. That kind of talk is disappearing now. It's becoming acutely embarrassing. And this is a sign, I think, of the peak of things getting better. Eugenics was extremely popular at the time of the last peak. Popular across the political spectrum. The people who founded the Labour Party in eugenics. Clause 4 of the Labour Party was actually quite eugenic, if you look at it, to secure for the workers by hand or by mind. Because there are two people, those who use their hands and those who use their brain, the fruits of their labour. We have a kind of milder form of eugenics nowadays. It's called allowing children to realise their potential. It's a really telling phrase, because the implication is that children have different potentials, and once they've realised it, that's it. And I think that's like, it's much nicer than eugenics. It's not nice, but it's not as nasty. In times of greater quality, in countries of greater quality, my favourite one is Finland, people don't talk like that. Partly because on average, their children can speak at least 3 or 4 languages, all of them, and slightly quicker ones can speak 6 or 7 by the time they're 16 years old. You know, that's the potential of an entire nation. Potential's almost endless if you let people free. And one of the sad things I find in Britain at the moment, when you're very, very unequal, you actually limit the potential and opportunities of people at the top. They're very, very constrained. If you're in a family in the top 1 or 2%, which means your mum and dad are earning about £200,000 a year, going to university is almost obligatory. The real question is which one? And if it's not the right one, you've already failed at age 18. You get your degree, they probably pay for you to do a master's degree. They might nowadays pay for you to do a PhD. That never existed when I was doing a PhD. And then you have to do work if you're not really, really high up on a trust fund. But your job must very quickly pay you in your mid to late 20s, 40, 50, 60,000 pounds a year. And there are only a few jobs to do that. So you have to become a lawyer or an accountant or work in PR. You can't do other things. And also you mustn't mix with people who are not like you. and that increases in the time of inequality. The best book of this is Lady Chatterley's Love. Lady Chatterley's Love was banned when it was written, because it was about the garden of a lady, and famously, when the obscenity trial was held in the 1960s, and the book was allowed to be published, and the judge said to the jury, "Is this a book you would like your wife or servants to read?" But that moment was all about how the country had changed. And back in the 60s and 70s, people were much, much freer if they were heterosexual. You know, not everything was great, but if you were heterosexual, you were much freer to marry and mix with who you wanted, because the gaps between you were less, and wedding wouldn't be embarrassing. You wouldn't have to sign a prenup agreement. Just terrible, terrible thing is prenup agreements. You know, we love each other very much, we want to stay ready for the rest of our lives, but by the way, can you sign a contract in case you split up? Those things that only happen in places of great inequality, because when you're more equal, you don't have these great differences in income and wealth. Also, you're not so scared of losing it. There's an enormous fear at the top of society about falling down, because down is falling into a different realm. I occasionally get to meet extremely rich people because of my job. And what's interesting about extremely rich people is suddenly they realize when they look at me, I'm a tenured university professor, I cannot be sacked. My salary is high, I have a mortgage. They look at me and they can't imagine living my life, because mortgages are for little people. And it's, if you want another way of explaining this, it's if you went to quite a poor country like India 20 or 30 years ago, and you looked at how the well-off didn't look at people on the streets, just didn't see them as a way of surviving, it's similar in this country to not see it. And we do it, of course, with people who are homeless on the streets. You know, we have taught ourselves how to walk past, how not to look, how not to make eye contact, or you make eye contact, and it's a way of survival, because you can't imagine. I can go all on about not imagining. Yeah. Just you do it yourself in your own head. Try to work out how you would live next year on half what you have. And then think, how would you live on half again? You will have, because we're in a very unequal country, brothers or sisters or cousins who are living on two or three times more than you, and others who are living on two or three times less than you. And you will get together at Christmas. And it's just an odd state to be in.
That links into my next question, actually. One of the things in the book is that greater inequality engenders a fear of sharing. Mm. I was thinking particularly around housing. You say we concentrate our worry on our own housing, and we worry less about the wider economy becoming dysfunctional. Could you tell us a little bit about the link between how we have to reset our personal expectations, particularly regarding housing, if we ever want to see the changes necessary for our children to be more secure?
I mean, the great news about housing is we have never had more bedrooms in Britain than now. Not necessarily more houses and flats. We've been quite slow building them recently. But we've been adding lots of extensions. So we have more bedrooms per person than we've ever had. There are more bedrooms in London in residential flats and houses than there are people. Forgetting all the other bedrooms in hotels and hostels and so on. So if nobody wanted to share a bed with anybody else, it's very good that people share beds, it's quite efficient. But if nobody wanted to share a bed with anybody else, everybody in London could have their own bed. What happened, and we measured this each census, I'll do you a graph. Becky Tunstall did this brilliantly from the University of York. She started in 1911, and in 1911, the best off 10th of people, I think, had something like four times as many rooms per person than the worst of 10. Actually, that inequality increased in 1921. And then it got better and better, 31, 40, 51, 61, 71. 81 was actually the peak of air quality in Harrogate. In 1981, the best of 10 had 3 times more booms per person than the worst of 10. But we'd never been more better housed than then. A third of the population were housed by the state, based on the allocation of need. And then the graph just goes up like this, 91, 2001, 2011, highest inequality ever by housing, the best of 10 for people now have 5 times as many bedrooms each as the worst of 10 has. That's only 2 or 3 properties, but also there just being 1 or 2 of you in a house with many, many rooms. Why do we do it? Partly because we can. Holiday homes become acceptable. My mum and dad live in the west coast of Wales, when they first went there, when they retired there, it was full of local people. Every time a local person died, the house was sold to somebody from London or Birmingham who bought it as a holiday home. The most amazing thing I learned recently, many of the people who bought all these little terraces and cottages near Barmouth, if you know Wales, they've set up companies. So their company has actually bought it so they can avoid paying taxation on it. So you have these empty houses just used for a few weeks of the year. But the other kind of thing that goes on with housing is that quite a few elderly women are much more likely to end up on their own than men, because a man dies earlier, end up in 4-bedroom houses, which they can't necessarily afford to heat, which they own outright, which they carry staying on in, because the longer they stay in, the higher it can work, and when they die, the more money their grandchildren will get. And their only chance for their grandchildren is the inheritance from their house. And so downsizing wouldn't be in the interest of their immediate family, because the aggregate wealth of the family would be less. But that behavior means we increase the inefficiency. The last one I'll say about housing, just to give you an idea of how ridiculous it is. We built a lot of the social housing in London quite late in the 70s. We built a lot of maisonettes. And these are often 2 bedrooms, husband and wife, and 2 children of the same sex. Once a child gets over 10, if they're different sexes, you need a 3-bedroom house with the old walls. Four people in a maisonette. With a sign outside saying no ball games, which was a bit sad because the children want to play ball games. When that couple realised that they could purchase the council house under right to buy, with a 40% discount if they'd given it long enough, you purchased the house. When they went to sell the house was increasingly bought by a landlord, not by somebody else. That landlord then puts the house on the open market, and the person who can bid the highest is a single young professional who ends up living in a council maisonette with a sign saying no ball games outside on an estate with no children anymore, populated at 4 times less density, full of young professionals, angry that they have to live in such a shabby home. Meanwhile, the families with 2 children can't get a maisonette anymore, and hence we have large numbers in B&B accommodation in our cities. And it's just ridiculous. It's not as if the people at the top are generally that happy. We're not as bad as the US. I'll never forget when John McCain was running for president. He couldn't remember how many houses he had. It was actually 11, they think. We're the nearest country in Europe to US levels of extravagance. I remember people trying to add up David Cameron's, I think it was 5 at one point, and a small estate outside Scunthorpe, which is my phone. Tony Blair, was it 50 properties at one point? You know, this kind of, his and Chile's property portfolio. That's the kind of thing that happens at a time of peak inequality. It's seen as okay and respectable, despite the obvious fact that if you are enriching yourself in this way, the money has to come from somebody else who is struggling. Michael Meacher, a nice old Labour MP on the left of the Labour Party, accidentally ended up, I think, with a dozen flats. So it's across the political board. But when we become all equal, as we did in the 40s and 50s, the Conservatives famously outbuilt Labour. But they still managed to build more council houses of a fairly high quality in 1 year than Labour ever had them. So in times of greater quality, you have this incredible base amongst your political parties to be better and nicer. In times of great inequality, in general, as it's rising, all your political parties tend to support inequality. The famous phrase from Labour at the time was, we're not worried about what the rich earn as long as they pay their taxes. Whereas actually you do have to worry about what the rich take, because nobody can earn that much. It is not possible to work so hard that you deserve that amount of income. The reason to be optimistic about this is Europe is a wonderful experiment at the moment. All of Europe was very unequal in the 1950s, very, very similar. All across Europe, inequalities came down. They partly came down. One reason was the Russian Revolution and the First World War. The Russian Revolution concentrated the minds of the rich, who did realise at the time of the Russian Revolution things could get very tricky for you if you do carry on taking so much. The First World War was very expensive and taxation was raised on the rich. We found polite ways to deal with it in Britain. So when we took somebody's house away from them because they couldn't pay the inheritance tax, they were able to donate it to the National Trust. Whenever you go to the National Trust property and look at that plaque, it's worth remembering what really went on. Europe became pretty equal in the 70s. We were the second most equal country to Sweden. And then the countries went in different directions. Our inequality soared at the highest. At the other end, Norway and Finland and the Netherlands became more equal than they were in the 1970s. Of the big countries in Europe, the most equal is France. If you have a third child in France, you get more child benefit than for the first two children. Whereas in Britain, of course, well, in England, you get none. In Scotland, you do now. The next is Germany. Spain's a bit more unequal, Italy's a bit more unequal, but we are even more. And because of this wide range of inequalities across Europe, it's like having a set of fish tanks in which you put a different amount of poison. It's like a natural experiment. And so we can measure things like people's health, and we see a relationship which is very close. We can measure the overall educational ability of the children, and we find that it's very closely related to the inequality in society. It's not that inequality is necessarily the magic bullet. What I think it is, although equality is very powerful, because the greater equality helps people at the top as well as people at the bottom live lighter and more free. Governments that manage to curtail inequality are good at planning. They're good at controlling their society in general. Populations who are good at voting in politicians who will curtail inequality are also populations who are good at voting in politicians who do things like organise a really good public transport system. So there's a really close relationship, a beautiful relationship between walking and cycling to work and using cars and inequality. And then the more unequal countries, people are much more likely to have to use a car, the US being the highest. In more equal countries, people use trains or trams or cycles or walk. And of course, it isn't that people wake up in the morning and go, hey, it's an equal country, I'm going to get my bike. What happens in more equal countries is that they have planning. I think your planning is a good thing. And the planners try to arrange cities so that workplaces are relatively near to where you live. And they also try to arrange cities so that there's enough houses for everybody in the city. In an unequal place like the US and the UK, the mantra is the market is the all-powerful decider and we'll get things right. The extreme case we have now in this country is schools. I live in Oxford, which is what I keep on going on about, and Oxford has a growing population, so we need a new school. No local authority is allowed to build a new school anymore. If you happen to live in an affluent part of the country, it's only affluent parts of the country where the population is rising, and there aren't enough schools, a group of parents has to get together and create a preschool. And what happens, of course, is that a group of on average, I may be generalising, but it tends to be the parents in the best off place in the city who do this. And despite the fact it might be obvious that the school is missing from one area or another, because it would make sense to put your schools evenly so that children can have the shortest journey to school in the morning, what happens, completely out of politicians' control, is a group of parents get money from the central government and get a piece of land near where they live and create another school in their part of the city, which might already have most schools. And then you have the children moving towards that area. Yeah, the idea that we assume the market will sort these things out tends to be a hell of a mess. If you want to compare with equality in different countries, go to a town or city the size of yours in another country and asking, how do the schools work? It's one of the most telling things. How are the children sorted out in the morning? It varies across England, but in my city, which is similar to London, similar to Bristol, 1 in 3 of the children are going off to school their parents are paying for. They're often driven. They almost never mix with the other children. Occasionally it guides or grannies. It isn't really mixing. They don't necessarily mix with each other in those private schools because they have to do entrance tests. And if you fail the entrance test, you have to go to an effective secondary model in private schools. And parents pay for their children to go to schools where they fail the test. And then there are 6 secondary schools in my city, state schools. And between each one, there is a £100,000 house price barrier. It is absolutely shocking. Oxford is filled with bomb. If you talk to a teacher in Bonn, in the German city of Bonn, and you ask them to rank the schools, they scratch their head. It takes them a long time. Eventually they say to you, oh, the Beethoven Academy, that is a bit posher. That's where Angela Merkel's kind of party people send their children. Then I ask them, what about the private schools in Bonn? And they laugh. They go, oh yes, we've got one. It's for rich, rather stupid boys. And then, of course, you know who went there? It's like, it's your Prince Philip. Look, this is, it's these kind of things. We're used to us. We're like the frog in the kettle. We were living quite an equal, quite a good life as a society in the 70s. It got worse. We blamed all kinds of things for that. And as we became more and more unequal, we largely come to accept it. When the food banks first opened, it was a little bit of a shock. It wasn't so much of a shock that we did something to stop it. And then, of course, there were famous disagreements with various politicians saying, this is wonderful, it shows how great charity is. We need more and more and more food banks. You know, the implication being that some people should only be fed if other people are willing to feed them through charitable means. Which is how our hospitals used to work before 1948. And was incredibly inefficient. Sorry.
No, it's great. We at the Trust and Trust, our vision is to see an end to the need for the banks in the UK. And so, we recognise that the shock factor is diminishing, and it's becoming more and more accepted. Last year, we saw a 20% increase in the number of people coming to food banks. We gave out 1.6 million through the emergency food supplies, 500,000 to children, and yet there's not an outcry in the country. And you can see it going up a bit this year. We were able to bring an end to soup kitchens.
Yeah.
What needs to change? I got quite a lot of hope from the Euro, I have to say.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be hard to hold on to that hope when we're facing these kind of situations. But what do we need in order to change? Because I think everyone here would want to see that change.
Yeah. The start is the beginning of a sense of outrage. We have that this year with the UN Special Rapporteur coming. Again, you can tell I'm a step on the city, but they picked out two schools in Oxford, two primary schools, where they are ladies, the little ladies, were going to the local food bank to get food to give children the free school meals they're entitled to because the school budget wasn't sufficient to actually do that. Now, I was luckily shocked the first day of hearing that, and the problem is you get used to it. And it's, things can get so bad because of that acclimatisation. It's beginning to be imaginative about ways out of this. The word unemployment in Britain was only created in 1888. We didn't have a word before then. Nobody was unemployed, you just starved. People suggested introducing unemployment benefit, and said, "Oh, this is madness." Of course, now we live in a society where we're not willing for people to actually be completely destitute. We need to think about what we will have to do to stop people being in this situation. My favourite solution that's suggested at the moment, which is being tried around the world in various different forms, is universal basic income. It's very, very efficient. It's like child benefit, but it's for everybody. You first of all introduce it at a very, very low level, so probably not quite enough to feed yourself to get it in, because it makes more sense for food to be supplied by a large supermarket or a nice corner shop. You go, get your food with the money that you get because you have universal basic income, rather than having this army of volunteers stacking these food banks, which just is not, all that human effort could be used for something else. And there will and are enough other things to be done. That's my preference for how we begin to do it. We move our benefit system towards universal basic income, which isn't means tested. So you get to the point where everybody has enough money for food. The other one is controlling food prices, which they do in other countries, particularly in times of crisis. They did it in Greece. We will have to worry about it because the prices of food are rising and about to rise faster. And there are ways in which you can make sure that your basic staples and vegetables and things with enough nutrition and vitamin are affordable and available. The co-op movement is still supplying food and doing it very, very well, your local co-op stores. But just see this as a priority. It has to be sorted out. You can set yourself targets. You can say, within 3 years we will do this, within 6 years we'll do this, within 9 years we will do this. You have to believe that that's worthwhile. And while we're run by people who think that this is the mode to serve them, this kind of thing will lead to terrible inefficiency. That's why it doesn't happen. You have to be honest about it. And it's different in Scotland. Just keep an eye on Scotland. The attitude in Scotland of Scottish people to other Scottish people has been very different from what we have in England. It's not very far away. So we don't even have to look across the sea to see things operating differently. Just an idea that basic human rights, food and shelter should be respected. My pessimism is, in the past, this has always been slow. Becoming more equal and getting better has tended to take a couple of decades. The only times it has ever been sudden is when a country has lost a war. And we really don't want to have a war. But there is no example we have in the data of a sudden dramatic improvement in a couple of years, other than losing wars. Losing wars are the most effective way for society to become better, It's quite ironic, because the first thing that happens when you lose a war, Finland, one reason why Finland does better than the other Scandinavian countries is that Finland lost a war. They're quite quiet about the fact that they were on the side of the Germans. When you lose a war, the first thing that happens is your league go. You don't want them because they took you to a war you lost, and the invading force doesn't want them either. So the people who used to keep most of the money for themselves, well, they're hiding, but they're certainly not no longer there. The other thing that happens is that this sense that some people are not worthwhile and some are more worthwhile can't be sustained after losing a war. The most extreme case in world history is Japan. Japan was one of the most unequal countries in the 1930s, had an almost feudal social class system. The Americans did us a great favour. They were very frightened after they bombed Japan and then invaded. They were worried that there would be a revolution in Japan. All the circumstances were provided for a communist revolution in Japan. And they were also very worried about the number of abortions. There were over 6 million abortions around 1945-46. The Americans were scared that this would be seen as their kind of equivalent for the Holocaust. What America did in Japan was take all the land from the landowners and distribute it as evenly as possible in a very small number of years, entirely destroying the existing class system, apart from the emperor, who was left at the top, and create the first society in the world where 90% of people were the same class. And there's no word for it. When 90% of people are the same class, you don't know whether to call them middle class or working class. And it was a natural experiment. What happened is Japan went from having one of the lowest life expectancies in the rich world to now having the highest. Incredible educational achievements. The industry did really, really well in the 80s and 90s. Japan is kind of ahead. Germany is another example. Germany, after losing the war, partly because of armed intervention, each city was given a different function. German society was very equal. The school system, which does divide you at teenage ages, but which treats technical education really, really seriously. And so you have families where somebody goes to university and somebody doesn't, but you don't have this kind of gulf that we have. Between where you go or not. Now, one reason amongst many that why we are the most unequal country in Europe is it's not just that we have an empire or that legacy. We're also the only place that wasn't invaded or lost. And so some of our old inequalities carry on because of that. The families who were given most of land in Devon by William the Conqueror still own 90% of the land in Devon. We have some very, very ancient inequalities in this country because of lack of invasion, lack of losing the war, lack of a complete reorganisation of our society. But we did manage, despite all of that, in the 60s and 70s, this incredible, short, brief period of equality. And we forget things. There was a circular 10 that the 1964 government came out, that for the first time we would create schools to which all children could go equally. Now that was a revolution in British education to do that. Now some counties held out, they kept their grammars and secondary models, but that kind of thing happened, and that kind of thing is possible again. At some point, with all the corruption in the academy chains, which is immense, our academy schools are now run by trustees who are unelected, unaccountable. All the schools in Oxfordshire, the state schools, are academies. You can look up trustees. I have a little hobby when I get bored. Half the trustees of the school that my children go to are also company directors. This is a state school, comprehensive. They're company directors. You look at the company accounts, and apart from the Formula One man, it actually is a company. The others are these fake companies, no employees, simply designed to avoid paying tax. My children are going to a school where the power is not held by the governors or the governing body, the power is held by a group of business people who are especially immobile. The man who was the head teacher of the school 10 years ago is now on a salary, I think, of over £200,000, which he decides himself as the chief executive of the academy train that he's created. He sends his children to Abingdon Private School for £30,000 a year and drives such an exclusive car that has a number on the side because it's a limited edition of 100. And the children know this. It's semi-feudal. This was a secondary modern school in the night when I was growing up as a young child in Oxford. And to go in such a short time from a secondary modern school where the failures had to go to a comprehensive school which was much more equal, to what then became the Tatler recommended posh comprehensive of Oxford magazine, to a school now owned and controlled by a group of trustees who are completely unaccountable, who do not send their own children there, but are in charge of the school as some kind of charitable nice thing they do for those people beneath them. And those people beneath them, including the sons and daughters of university professors, who don't have the sense to send their own children to private schools because that's what we should do. You know, what a messy country it is. We will get out of this because it's just silly. It doesn't work. You don't have a happy set of people who go off to Abingdon School. You know, it doesn't create a good country. If the top 1% were really living very, very happy lives, and the top of the 10% beneath them were, the thing would be more sustainable. But they're not. Living lives of fear and worry, constantly trying to get more. So I have an optimism about it. I do not think the inequality is going to get worse. I think it's going to come down. I just think it's going to be a slog of a fate for 20 years, constantly saying it's too high, it has to come down more. We have to have higher marginal tax rates at the top incomes, not to raise money. Some Conservatives just don't understand this. But the reason why you need to tax income, most of you have taxed income of over 50,000 a year, about 50%. We need to tax income of over 100,000 a year, say 60%, 150%, 70%, and so on. Not to raise more money, actually to raise less. High marginal income tax rates deter companies from wasting money paying something that much. There was a case a few years ago between Barclays and Lloyds where they both had two young traders and the traders were both being paid about $4 million a year, and then one heard that the other one, because of pay rise, was getting $6 million a year and demanded another $2 million a year so that he could get six. Now if you imagine that they were paying 90% tax on that marginal extra, then the executives at Barclays, I think he would be sitting around saying, well, we could give you another $2 million. But actually, you're only going to get 200,000 of that. And 1.8 billion would be paid straight to the Treasury in tax. So we're not going to. It wouldn't mean that Barclays trading didn't work. Trading is not that difficult. Right? Really, really not. You know, you would still manage to do it. The Swiss pay their bankers half as much, and their banking system is more solid than ours. We currently pay over 3,000 bankers over €1 million a year. 3,000. The European Banking Authority publishes these figures. The next highest country in the whole of Europe is Germany, who pay 197 bankers more than €1 million a year. Our bankers, and banking is the extreme of this, say that if you didn't pay us as much, we'd go elsewhere. There is nowhere to go because nobody else are paying the salaries. The only place is New York, and the Americans have taken those jobs already. And they're not going to take a whole set of British bankers who haven't got as having good track records. One reason I think we're at the peak is that they actually increased recently, just before Brexit, hasn't gone down. And I looked at it going up and I thought, oh, you're just trying to cash in. In the last few minutes, because you know this can't continue for much longer. You know the minute a more progressive government comes in, they will stop this kind of behaviour. They will introduce higher marginal taxes, they will raise corporation tax. We will have wealth taxes being experimented with. Standard Life Foundation have a charity who are actually doing reports about wealth taxes now, which ones to do, and there will be green taxes. And there'll be taxes on air flights, because we have to find a way to stop people flying so much. And there'll be subsidies for the trains. You know, all that, that's all planning. If you don't plan in society, you end up with people flying all over the place, enormous pollution. Most of the people who fly on Ryanair, EasyJet, the social class A, B, C, 1, right, they are us. It's not some great mind for working class to go on holiday. More planning and organisation of society is the kind of thing you need. We've done the experiment, we've taken it away, we're letting inequality rise. I'm going to shut up very soon. If you could tell me some advantage of this inequality, I just don't see it. At the extreme, I compare pop stars around what? Of the top 1%, over 95% work in finance and industry. But about 3% are pop stars and sports stars and celebrities. Tiny proportion, we often tend to think of them. When do pop stars do better? You can actually look at the life expectancy of pop stars. And the worst place to be a pop star is the United States. And I don't have to tell you any names, you can think of number one hits and how they died young there. The best place to be a pop star is Sweden. All four of them have decided to stay and pay really high taxes. Sorry.
We've got time for a couple of questions from the floor. I can take two at a time. Gentlemen at the front and ladies, someone's going to run to you with a mic.
I'm a trainee unionist in my workplace, and also got involved in setting up the Kingston Anti-Cuts Group, campaigning against the austerity measures of the coalition government. During that period, we have to take seriously the arguments from the right on causes of deprivation and poverty. And Ian Duncan Smith's Centre for Social Justice, populated by quite a few Christians who think that people have to let the straw out, not bow the straw. Now, regarding, they made the argument that deprivation, the fastest route to it, was through relationship breakdown. As Christians, we're quite into the idea of relationships and equality, because we're all making the image of God. We have a foundation or narrative about the importance of dignity of every individual. They argued that because of the collapsed support for important social institutions that historically the church has supported, I think specifically marriage, that it's the tragedy of partnering that breaks down those who've never married, particularly those with children, and that therefore child poverty is linked to relationship breakdown because of the collapse in support important social institutions like marriage and the student obligation through the generations. I just wonder what your assessment work is of the Centre for Social Justice's reports around routes to deprivation. I'm thinking of drug addiction, I mean, mental illness, all of that.
So I'm just
going to
take this lady's question as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
One of the indicators in your book is the inequality of funding regionally by arts council in England. How important do you think access to heritage and arts is for creating an equal society?
Okay. I'll do that one first. It's easier. As our inequality rose, we took away opportunities for people to do arts We took them away from schools. There used to be much more opportunity to do music in schools, and now that's less and less. Tony Blair took away the fifth option. You used to be actually be unemployed and learn a guitar in your garage. You know, and that actually was, I mean, ironically, he, I've never seen Tony Blair play a guitar, but he famously was in a band. And then the Arts Council, the funding is incredibly concentrated in London and not outside. It's relatively cheap to do this. One reason that I'm very in favour of universal basic income is I want lots and lots of people to be making art in their houses, to be doing music on a very low income. Partly because they'll be happy, partly because they will consume less and it's less pollution. So I think it's circular. The garden in particular institute is well worth looking into. On the kind of scale of dodgy, particularly dodgy, extremely dodgy, and really worryingly dodgy, the garden is at the top end, more even than the Taxpayers' Alliance. The marriage breakdown thing is fascinating, because again, we can compare countries and we can compare over time. When most of our statistics are about illegitimacy for children, we actually have lots of counts of bastardy in this country. You know, actually count how many children are bastards, historically. But we have very good records of marriages in different countries and of marriages breaking up and divorce. And the relationship over time is that countries which become more unequal later on have a higher rate of people separating. And the implication is that staying together is great. I mean, instead, you can only go if you manage to do it. It's highly efficient, the grass isn't greener on the other side and so on. But it's much easier to stay together when there are less stresses in your relationship. And what causes stress in relationships above all else is money. One of you losing your job, feeling that you've failed, those are the kind of precursors. Somebody getting ill is one of the other ones. In the Smith Centre has done is ask about face. They've taken one of the things that increases when you become a more unequal society, which is relationship breakdown, and then they've associated that with having caused the poverty and inequality right the other way around. So I once went on a study tour of Japan where we're doing lectures about troubled families. It took me some time to realise why things weren't working. Me and the central academics were doing these talks, and the sort of Japanese colleagues were doing talks. Their talks were in Japanese, ours were in English, and we were both being translated. The translation was a bit stilted. And I suddenly realised that what the Japanese meant by troubled families was 1.5% of families where the mother was seriously mentally ill, and it was a real problem with the children, and it was very, very small, because Japanese society is much more cohesive now, because it's a society that in some ways is more equal. What we were talking about was a quarter to a third of families finding it hard, and then the government deciding that there were 120,000 of their troubled families. So if you want people to be able to keep relationships together, you need to place a society in which it's easier to do that and not make it harder for them. Ian Duncan Smith is really, really worth going into detail on him and trying to work out where his ideas come from, what was the relation. He, of course, himself was unemployed for a time. But of course his wife's wealth meant that was meaningless apart from time. So he's an interesting experiment in the effects of unemployment when it doesn't affect your income at all. And he famously went up to Glasgow and supposedly had an epiphany in the East House estate, but appeared to have learned nothing from it at all. He said at the beginning, I'm one of the members of the think tank class. The person who runs the think tank class is Pfizer Shaheen. Pfizer is currently standing for the Labour Party against Ian Duncan Smith in his constituency, which is the constituency in which she grew up as a child. And it's He hasn't yet debated her. He will have to at one point, unless he decides what to stand. He will almost certainly lose that seat. And this is going to be very interesting. He will never change his mind in his life, I suspect. Baroness Stroud, I suspect, will never change her mind, although at least she no longer talks about converting people who are homosexual the way she once did. It's the effects of these small groups of people who believe these things. At times of great inequality, their messages are taken seriously. Mostly was taken seriously in the 20s and 30s because we were still quite unequal. Eugenicists were taken seriously in the past because we were. You try and preach eugenics in the 50s and 60s and you just get laughed at. And we had a sense in the 70s that a decent wage was fine to get and everybody deserved to have leisure time and recreation. And we had a sense that everybody should have a job and a job that they could choose. And that the most powerful point we ever got to, which we can get to again, and Universal Basic Income gives you this, is we got to a point in the 70s where if you didn't like your job, you just told your boss to stuff it and you walked out and got another job. That improved the quality of employment massively. You know, if you really want good jobs, you need people to have the power to walk away from those jobs. Market forces is the way to do it.
Thank you so much. Thank you everyone for being here today. I want to applaud. Well, one of the things that I said in this book is people make policies and policies can be changed. One of the policies you want to see changed is the 5 week wait that people have to wait for their first benefit payment. The trust of Cross Sam can sign up to sign up. Come around and see us this afternoon. Thank you.